This is tape five again, side B. I'm sorry, I interrupted you when you were talking about Judson's book, and we were talking about
his history of science theory.
Right.
I think that I find thinking of histories of things comes naturally to me, and probably my first papers I attempted to write in a historical sequence. That is reporting the data in the order that we found it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work, not always, or it rarely works to report it exactly where you found it, because in order to compress for clarity's sake, you've got to fake it. You've got to present the data as if it was better organized and more clearly, and the experiments were more clearly thought out than they actually were.
Mm-hmm.
But I still like to think in historical terms. Maybe it comes from being Irish, but you're both thinking historical terms, how historically aware, and at the same time aware that, for the Irish, one of the things has been a problem. Their problems is being a prisoner of your history. So it's good to know your history, but not to be bound
right by
it.
Trey said, "History is the nightmare that I'm trying to wake."
Trying to awake.
Right.
It's an issue for when you teach genetics, actually. It's the big question for every genetics textbook and every genetics course. Do you start with Mendel or do you start with DNA?
Right.
Do you start with the what we know of now as the mechanism, or do you start with what some people would think is the more satisfying way of starting with the observations and then working your way through the stories? I think I would tend these days to think that it's not fair to expect students to work their way through, to share the pain,
mm-hmm.
to expect them to work their way through the history, that you should convey our best understanding of the way the world works first, and then throw in the history where it's relevant, but not necessarily do Mendel first.
Right.
For the sake of
it. So it supplements it, in a sense. Right.
Well, not so much. Well, yeah. So historical insight might supplement it,
mm-hmm.
but that can come later. That can. We know this because,
right.
For some selected experiments, where the design of the experiment is so nice, and the design itself is so informative, then it's worth establishing. We know why we know what we know, and going into the background for the experiments, but there's a certain amount of nostalgia that everyone who learns genetics takes on board and likes talking about,
mm-hmm.
that can be jettisoned for a lot of genetics courses, I think.
Right. Do you feel that scientific progress is inevitable?
I think that it is. I think it's unidirectional in the sense that it is real. We do learn more about the world. We do know more about the world than we did before.
Mm-hmm.
If I didn't think that, I wouldn't enjoy what I do, because what I enjoy most, the top moments in my scientific career have been, now I know something real about the world that I didn't know before,
mm-hmm.
And that perhaps that no one knew before. But I think it's the idea that enlightenment is always historically, and scientific enlightenment is always, can be taken for granted. I don't believe anymore. I think the people do seem to have this scientific knowledge, and knowledge of the scientific world is not natural to people. And you can see that, I think, in the last decade or so, I think we've regressed rather than progressed in that way.
Mm-hmm.
That there's more people who view the world in a less empirical way than there were before, and those people have more influence than they did before.
Mm.
So I would say that maybe for too long, scientists and people who view the world in an empirical way have been too quiet and too reticent. That, of course, I'd include myself in that, about defending not just their turf in kind of the narrower funding for research way, but also in the way of why this is the best way to look at the world, and why when you see things that are just wrong scientifically and empirically and are a bad way of looking at the world. It goes back to the idea about bad information. Bad information, there is such a thing as bad information, and it should always be defended against. That error is, there's lots of harmless errors out there, but there are some really harmful ones. And our only defense at bottom is either religious principles, which don't work because they are different for different people, or empiricism.
Right. A question about technology. What effect has technology and technological innovation had on your work and research?
We've benefited by it without contributing all that much to it, I guess. My own technological innovations have been so homemade and crafty. Things like my little fly motel or way of doing auditory recordings from flies. When it comes to my own work, I'm very cheap, I like making things simple, and elegance for me means frugality and cheapness. However, we've been benefited enormously from confocal microscopy, which we've got a nice new Leica sitting across the corridor that's shared with other labs, and that's a fantastic tool for especially now that we're trying to do GFP tagging of proteins that localize to very small structures in the cell and in very small amounts, where we would not be able to acquire that data if we didn't have access to that technology. So we benefit by it a lot. It's a truism for cell biology, especially, that the field is driven by technical advances.
I mean, there are some who argue too that this technology is becoming more and more expensive, and that is sort of creating a new division between one group of labs who have good funding and can buy these gizmos and the others that don't. Do you feel that division is growing, or that division exists?
I think that, yes, I'm not sure. I think equipment, it's related to the issue of why medicine is so expensive in some ways, that once developed and patented and put out there, instrumentation has to stay expensive in order to keep the revenue stream afloat. And perhaps things like confocal microscopes could become cheaper, and there would be a way of for some scientific equipment, there's a tendency to, just like anything, cars or whatever, to add more bells and whistles rather than to develop a cheaper, more streamlined version of something that'll do the job. It might be good if there is some more simplicity there. The confocal is probably the most expensive thing we use, and it's shared between about five labs, shared between more labs than that, but used intensively by about five labs. And that seems to be so far as working out well as a way of doing things. I think I'm talking from the side of a lab that's been funded for a while, so I would be saying things differently. I think there's a responsibility on people like paper reviewers and journal editors not to demand. I remember for a while when I was back in Barry's lab, papers were turned down because we hadn't done single channel recording or single channel voltage clamp. Really was no reason to. It was just there was that technology was there. It was state of the art, and every paper ought to have it in it. But even though it wasn't necessarily going to answer the scientific question that the paper posed or answered. So there's an issue of whether technology can be applied or not. There's a lot of technology out there now that's in search of, technology in search of questions. A lot of the omics But that's inevitable. I mean, it's genomics has been such a big boon to labs, and I think it has made that sort of centrally available technology that produces a lot of information that is publicly available is great.
Right. You know,
it's been nothing but positive for researchers, at least.
This question, too, is apropos of...
That comes from my own experience in positional cloning. When I had to do that by, you know, mm-hmm. going from having to positionally clone by, do a 200 kb chromosome walk by hand, 3 years of a graduate career.
Right.
Most things are better than that.
Right, this question gets a little bit... you mentioned Judson's book, mm-hmm. The Eighth Day of Creation. We often read, or the public does at least, of a biological revolution taking place. In your opinion, I mean, has that happened?
Yes.
In what way? What type of revolution?
Because this is a time not like no other. You know, I've told that over the last 3 years that I teach the genetics class, I tell them, this is unique. This is a unique time in history. Never again will you be the class that have learned genetics in the year when you know your own genome sequence. The last class didn't. You do. Well, we can give a say. You've got 35,000 genes. We didn't know that last year.
Right.
Now we do, with some error. But we know to a much greater certainty than we did before. If you see the impact that I'm most impressed by is the impact in the legal system, the impact in courts, and that's having really, I hope, deep philosophical underpinnings, because it goes all the way to one of the attractions of molecular biology is the certainty of the information. You clone, therefore you can amplify a thing, and something that was a fuzzy piece of data becomes a yes or no answer. Mm-hmm. It's this base or that base, and there's no arguing with that. You can argue about interpretations, you can argue about the statistics behind it, but you can't argue with the primary data. And that's been the big attraction for so many people to go into molecular biology, and probably was for me too, that having been able to approach questions and to be sure that however difficult it was to get to, that there was that certain answer was there waiting for you.
Translate
that degree of certainty into DNA identification. This morning I read, you know, guy who was first, I think in St. Paul, for the first time a prosecutor initiated DNA investigation on a freed man who was convicted of rape 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. That degree, bringing that degree of certainty to a legal area, where there was an equal degree of certainty, but with far less justification, mm-hmm. has now led to things as, you know, far-reaching as beginning to question people's trust in eyewitness evidence, very justifiably. So that degree of knowledge about ourselves is something that's an instance where I think the effects are largely good, the ability to exonerate with certainty.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's the flip side of the coin, which is that now we can have large-scale mass screening for DNA polymorphisms. That's possible in theory, probably within a year or two in practice.
Mm-hmm.
And may or may not be a good thing, depending on how much information you think governments should have. I think one of the questions I like posing to a genetics class arises from a given example of, you know, to what degree genotype should determine the way we treat people. There's a paper came out a few years ago now saying a polymorphism for the serotonin transporter made people more or less anxious. So I posed the hypothetical question as a letter from a student addressed to me as a genetics lecturer, you know, existing practice, we give accommodation to students with disabilities. And disability means, in effect, they can go to the student counselor or student health service or the student disability service and get a note from them saying so-and-so has a disability unspecified that will affect their exam-taking performance. That means we can give them... they should be able to take the exam in a separate room and have extended time for it.
Right.
That's current university policy. I say, okay, so here's a letter saying, somebody says, dear professor, I'm homozygous for the long polymorphism of the serotonin transporter. Mm-hmm. It has been shown that, which is true, that this is associated with increased anxiety levels. Therefore, I would like to try I'd like to claim special circumstances under which I should take the exam. Mm-hmm. Should they be given that? The class is always divided on them. And you can influence the outcome of their answers by telling them, for instance, that most people carry the more anxious polymorphism. So that means we've got to make the minority of the class take the test under more anxious, anxiety-inducing conditions of what might those be.
That's a good example, too. It hits home. You know.
But I like bringing the example to something, an issue that they actually really care about right there and then, mm-hmm. and say, okay, you have this decision. What do you do? And I like to leave it somewhat open, but the bottom line is you don't judge on genotype, you judge on performance. If you're going to make the judgment, judge on performance, not on genotype. We don't know enough about the way genotype causes phenotype. Mm-hmm. It's not justifiable to do it. And also that you don't know the way in which the chain of reasoning is false, because because a polymorphism may be associated with anxiety, and anxiety may be induced with lower test performance, you don't know that the type of anxiety caused by the polymorphism is associated with test performance. It might make you study more anxious, so you might study better. You've got to be very sure of your we cannot be sure of enough of that chain of reasoning in order to predicate, to make judgments based on genotype mm-hmm. alone. The other way in which genetic information, I think it goes deeper in that sense, I think it really will ultimately challenge the way we view our sense of self. Who am I? Am I determined by my genotype or not? It's much easier to say, it's always been easy to say, people have a self, and I have the idea of themselves as independent agents that make their own decisions. Those decisions are the product of something they view themselves as independent agents in making those decisions. Mm-hmm. I've always been a little less sure about that, because I'm not, in some ways, I've always, in my own career track, I'm undecided. Have I always been following the path of least resistance? And have I been governed by circumstances the whole way along? I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's clear to me that one of the things people do best is post-hoc rationalization, making up stories to justify the things they've just done, and it's rationalizing why that was an independent decision according to them. Mm-hmm. So that is going to be challenged by genotyping, by the ability to correlate at least quantitative traits with screening for many polymorphisms at once that might be associated with those traits.
Mm-hmm. In an earlier session, you talked about you have tenure now, mm-hmm. and how important tenure is. What is the tenure getting process here at SUNY Stony Brook?
It's fairly conventional. By the end of your sixth year, a package is put together. Letters are solicited from outside people asking mm-hmm. for opinions. It's teaching is perceived as being quite important here, and perhaps more important more recently than in the past, since the university as a whole has moved towards putting more emphasis on looking after undergraduates, and, at least in intent. It's been, I'd say, the bar has not been set discouragingly high here. It's been, the tenure process, as it turned out, was actually fairly reasonable, even though it never seems so as you're going through it. Mm-hmm. And it was a close enough thing for me, I think, due primarily to the lack of publications, or low numbers of publications, that I was worried about it.
Right.
Since I'm by nature a worrier, not as a concept like tenure, I found has actually made me, I think, a better scientist. Hopefully I won't ever get too comfortable, but it's certainly given me the freedom to expand research into areas that may or may not pay off, mm-hmm. To ask questions that might or might not pay off.
All right, questions about competition and collaboration. Is competition generally good, do you believe, for science?
No. Not always. And I would, since I've, again, I'm not a confident scientist, therefore I'm usually, in the past I've been worried about losing out in competitions more than confident of my ability to win a competition.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather collaborate than compete. I'm not sure whether that's a good thing either, that you can have, you know, too many cozy arrangements, but it seems like the brass ring model of science distorts things. The idea that, here, let's set up a goal, you know, and let's everyone chase after this goal for a while in a thundering herd, and somebody gets it, and then everyone chases after another goal,
mm-hmm.
Is not necessarily the best way of doing things. It is if the goal is worth achieving, perhaps, but a lot of effort is wasted on a lot of by you can't but devalue other areas by fixing on one as something more important.
Right.
It's a spur to complete it, though. It's needed. It's particularly, again, for somebody like me, perhaps, to complete papers, to get things out faster. Ideas do need advocates. So if there's a scientific dispute, it's probably no bad thing to have one person invested a little more heavily than the complete objectivity would dictate,
mm-hmm.
in one interpretation and somebody else invested in the other. That's kind of a little bit of the legal adversarial model is probably good, just to make sure all ideas get thoroughly aired or tested or defended. But,
mm-hmm.
But temperamentally, I would rather not find myself in the competition. I'd rather, oh, look, we're working on the same gene. How about we do this, you do that, and let's try and avoid duplicating the work. Is typically the situation I'd rather find myself in.
Right. You've talked about some collaborations, but talk, if you would, I mean, what are the collaborations that you have now with scientists underway?
Underway. Let's see. Working from ones that have already resulted in publications, one of our mutations turned out to be a protein involved in the process called intraflagellar transport. There seems to be a conserved transcription factor that regulates genes involved in the process, including, we think, our gene. We've been collaborating with a group in France who had isolated mutations affecting the transcription factor, the regulatory factor.
Mm-hmm.
What often happens is that we end up doing the electrophysiology part of an analysis of a mutation like that. We did the electrophysiology for that paper. Even though the electrophysiology techniques we do are pretty simple, I keep saying, look, anyone could do this. But electrophysiology, I think, seems very intimidating. Anything involving an oscilloscope seems very intimidating to
right.
most molecular biologists, so they're happy to let us do it, and that's actually worked out well for us.
Mm-hmm.
We've got, arising from this stuff on ciliogenesis, we've got, from this last recent meeting that I went to, people who've come at centrosome and centriole-associated genes and proteins have found in a couple of instances that they're mutants. Some of the viable mutants tend to have behavioral phenotypes that they have been somewhat puzzled by and we recognize as probable sensory defects. We've been going after those and trying to, again, do electrophysiology and follow it up. What are the connections with our genes? The reason being that our sense organs are ciliated. Things involved in centrioles and centrosomes often have defects in ciliogenesis. Then the collaboration on polycystins. This is a case where we were going against our usual strategy, starting with the molecule without a mutation. Another group, one person in particular, Terry Watnick at Johns Hopkins, had made the investment in flies is substantial, of generating a targeted mutation in one of the molecules, come up with the mutation with a sort of a iffy male sterile phenotype. They'd wondered about whether they had a sensory defect, sent it to us to do electrophysiology. That was fine. And I asked, since we are also interested in spermatogenesis ourselves, I said, do you mind if I take a look at spermatogenesis and male other reasons for male fertility defects? Mm-hmm. They said, sure, and we found out this really interesting defect in sperm function and sperm storage. That seems to be what polycystins are involved in doing in flies. That I think, is a... I felt privileged to be allowed to do that experiment, since somebody else had put in all the work on making the mutation, mm-hmm. hard work. I think that's going to work out really well. We've got other collaborations, again, where other people have made mutations in ion channels, mutations which have turned out, we've done the electrophysiology to show that they were deaf.
Right.
So a lot of them have been spurred by, yes, we do this little thing that most other labs don't do, that we can provide as a
service.
As a service. That's
okay, given the limited resources of your lab, for that matter, any lab, mm-hmm. And then also I think the constraints that sometimes are attached to those resources, what criteria do you use in determining what projects move forward and what projects are shelved or not even begun?
Likelihood of getting to an answer. How the standards have changed as we know more. We now need to know more about a gene than we would have a few years ago in order to commit to it,
mm-hmm.
To commit a full, say, positional cloning effort to finding an unknown gene. We've got quite a few mutations on the shelf that could well be interesting, but right now we've got too few people working on projects that we're already engaged in to start another open-ended project with an unknown outcome. That said, though, we do spread ourselves pretty thin. We've got more projects in the lab going than we have people going doing them. In some cases, undergraduates have been very useful. And as people, low-cost people, at Stony Brook, you can get some extremely talented undergraduates. There's the top end of the Stony Brook undergrad population is really talented and very hungry. So, for instance, an undergrad generated the data that started kicked off the polycystin project. Another one right now is working on a very different side project, a larva, which turned up as a mutant larva in the original screen that I did for touch and sensitive mutations. It senses touch just fine, but it's all the larvae are twisted. And so if you take the whole larva and give it a quarter turn, and always in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
So it was such a strange phenotype and so intriguing that I just started, always sort of kept it on the shelf as my spare time, Saturday afternoon mutant.
Mm-hmm.
and it's probably telling us about a mechanism of muscle differentiation that's quite unrelated to the rest of the lab. For now, as long as we can have an undergrad working on it, it's worth keeping up.
Right.
But not wouldn't be worth putting the rest of the lab to work on.
Right. To take it sort of to a much broader level now, talk about sort of the nation's scientific agenda, its criteria for choosing what science is done and what science isn't. Fairly recently, there was a controversy about stem cell research, as you
mm-hmm.
know. And what that pointed up, among other things, was just, you know, who should be at the table to determine the direction of U.S. science, you know, where the money should be spent. Among the players are pressure groups, they're policymakers, they're politicians,
right.
scientists, all of these people, celebrities in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you were the head, let's say, of an imaginary commission that signs off on research projects, some of which might be as controversial, let's say, as stem cell research, I mean, who would you put on that commission generically? Who do you believe has a right to dictate the nation's research agenda? Maybe not the right, but who should?
It's getting to a level where I'm not sure. It depends on. There should be a full spectrum of research going on between completely unfettered, investigator-initiated, people following their noses, research, the sort of stuff that we, for, which is for the most part what we do. And targeted research. I'm not sure that there's really been a good... model yet for targeted research. In some ways, I think there's a lot of... I'm wondering if more people my age and at my stage in the scientific career would be willing to, for a short time maybe, like a sabbatical, take a break from the purely exploratory stuff and go and, be presented with a problem. Maybe in a working group, maybe say, okay, let's, here we've got this, probably a problem that's just beyond the edge of a obvious solution. And say, you know, you've got a year or 2 years to, two months to think about this, and a year to have a, or 2 years to have a best shot as possible devising a solution to it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, I've wandered a little bit from the original point that you were going to, that you were asking for, because I don't know the answer. Who should have a role in deciding?
I mean, another way to look at it is that obviously there are institutions afoot, the NSF, the NIH, institutions that set these guidelines that mm-hmm. in a direct, you know, have some control over the rudder, let's say, of this ship.
Right.
But so maybe the system isn't broke, me too, and it more or less functions properly. That's
right.
Also another possibility.
Right. It's hard to tell. I mean, you get a biased answer because once you're asking it to a scientist in a funded working lab, you're asking somebody for whom the system's working, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy. I get to do what I want. I'm incredibly lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And I still, you know, get that feeling that I can't believe I get paid for this.
Right.
Sometimes on good days. When I'm in the lab, not on good days. Doing all the other stuff. But it's... So the system is providing me with what I need. I don't know if it's providing... other people with what they need. I mean, maybe a little more conscious of it now, since we've the spouse of somebody in the lab has a serious cancer that she is struggling with right now, and it's right on the cusp of how you could see that, for instance, maybe next year the DNA array information for characterizing tumors might actually be useful in determining a treatment strategy for that, and wishing that things had moved a little faster,
right.
Even though it's still moving incredibly fast. Targeted, that's one area in which targeted research would seem to be really timely and possibly really useful.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to cast a broad net. I mean, in some ways it's the best thing about coming to the U.S., is that this is one place in which the net can be so broad. I think that as you go up the levels, the responsibility is more to see that that every area is covered, and that areas don't slip through the cracks just because that it isn't driven by force of personality of a single investigator or designation of a particular goal as being too broad. I mean, this last year, one of my colleagues told me that he quickly wrote a terrorism-related grant that he had quite a low opinion of, had no expectation of funding at all, had got a relatively moderate score, and was then called up and said, well, we've got lots of money, this is going to get funded.
Right.
That model is not necessarily the good of having the issue of the moment dictate the research. It's a self-correcting system. People will use suddenly available funds like that to do whatever research they want, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So I think it's when you have not a market-driven, but a marketplace of ideas-driven system as NIH extramural research is currently, a lot of it is, it has its own inherent stability just because of the sheer numbers of constantly independent-minded people who are involved in it. It's right. That's a lot of shit that's too hard to divert in one direction or another. Overall, I mean, you could see the atmosphere in science change when percentile funding levels go back up to the teens. Then people get more demoralized, and study sections get more demoralized.
Right.
And you get the sense that a lot of good science is not being getting done that should be.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well,
but as long as the fund percentile levels are somewhere a little over 20%, then if the net's being broad enough, gassed. One thing that I feel right now is that perhaps the institute organization, National Eye Institute hearing, is still a little, doesn't take enough into account the basic unity of biology.
Mm-hmm.
That, for instance, our ciliogenesis mutants, we expect to have defects on hearing, sight, on vision. In each case, we're going back to a level that's so broad in evolutionary terms, going back far enough in time to a last common ancestor was ancestral to all of these sensory cell types. Which institute do we apply? Not in some way, we could apply to any of them,
mm-hmm.
but none is really aware of the deep history of the cell biology of the organism that underlies human biology and even medicine. That
right.
To recognize the overall interest, and maybe there should be a, Institute for Basic Cell Biology that would be to whom that would be responsible for funding projects like that. So you wouldn't have to have that slightly dishonest feeling of saying that, yes, of targeting your very broadly based research to target a specific disease or.
To pick up again with the stem cell research, just to use it as an example, I mean, part of the problem with the controversy, I think, was sort of the alarmism surrounding it, and people were saying that, well, why is there this alarmism? Some pointed to scientists that, you know, the scientists hadn't maybe performed their function or could perform a better function of getting the word out.
Right.
Why is this important? And that would apply to other things as well, obviously, other types of research.
Yeah.
What, to your mind, should the proper role of sort of the average PI be in helping to determine public policy, questions about public policy?
I think it should be for those among whom I do not include myself, who have the gift of speaking clearly in public, they should be able to give a very clear idea of what we know for sure and what we don't. The stem cell issue and, with the whole relation to what constitutes, which is related to the idea of what constitutes a human life and when is it permissible to abort a potential human life or a human life, goes to a definition of what it means to be human. And in some ways it's, and the distinction between life and human life is something that science now has something to say. I think we could be more courageous about no longer ducking between the idea that there's the religious ethical view of things and the scientific view of things, and these are two different ways of looking at the world that have nothing to say to each other. I don't think that's true anymore. I think that when we do something like produce a human genome sequence or know intimately at the cell-by-cell development of a human, we do know something, there is a piece of knowledge that has moral and ethical implications. It's, it's almost an issue for it. Do you define a human by what they are or by what they do? In some ways, the idea of what you take as human, what the law and mainstream opinion might take as human, seems to be a more genetical definition than most geneticists would make. And that is, human is anything with a human genome. For any neurobiologist would say that you've got to have a certain level of nervous system complexity before you can be considered human. Mm-hmm. And that the degree to which you can make that there's scientists are going to be more fuzzier in their definitions because they're more aware of complexity than most people. Most of the people who are currently making the definitions and making the decisions now. However, since we live in a democracy, you can't have, no matter, even the best informed opinions cannot dictate the majority decision.
Mm-hmm.
And nor should they. So you've got to put the information out there with as much force that you know is right, with as much force and clarity as you can.
Right. Does Stony Brook encourage PIs like you and others to take part in these public policy questions? Or give you opportunities to do so?
There are public lectures. That Stony Brook faculty give biology faculty on a variety of public policy issues. I haven't yet been asked to give one directly, nor do I expect I would be. If I felt confident enough and that I had enough well thought through opinions, I'm sure I could get the opportunity to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Stony Brook has just opened a sort of a little mini campus, just some more of a suite of buildings in Manhattan. I know I've been thinking recently it would be a good place to maybe, if they were to initiate some sort of policy discussion. I was more thinking along the lines of a discussion of whether the research model for biomedicine is really an engine for making things more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be a good place to initiate something like that.
Right.
Or a little slightly peripheral out here on Long Island, but one of the issues that was dealt with recently was whether or not there is an increased risk of breast cancer on Long Island. Historically, there's been this long, apparently established fact that turns out to be a little fuzzy when you look at it close, that there is a significantly increased risk of breast cancer on Long Island. Mm-hmm. That's given rise to a lot of some celebrity-driven, some increased funding for research both at the university and elsewhere, which on the whole is good, but has also, some of our local friends are extremely, it makes them very scared, people who for whom, say, breast cancer runs their family and are genetic risk than environmental risks. They're just non-specifically scared of by that sort of publicity. More than they should be.
Mm-hmm. It's been recently stated in an article I read in The Scientist that about almost 65% of the R&D now for research and science comes from private sources. And, mm-hmm. and more and more we see sort of the privatization of scientific research. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that's a good trend?
No.
In what way?
Sure.
Is it not good?
Because I think the business model is not a good trend for doing, not a good model for doing, not science, at least not all of science. Because it's goal-directed, and goals are mistaken, and they're short-term, and they're And also because, part, I think it sucks a lot of the joy out of doing science. Mm. That, you know, it's something that, for not everyone, but for some people, should be something you enjoy doing all the time, and not because you're in it, not because of the money that you're going to make. People talk about how poorly paid scientists are. In my experience, that hasn't been the case, but I've been lucky. And I've made it through I'm a moderately well-paid person at a moderately successful mm-hmm. institution, and I feel incredibly lucky that I get to do what I do. Don't tell my chairman, but I think my salary is pretty good. Can we seal this part of it?
let me flip it over.